From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is KCRW's program of stories and original documentaries. It's a part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project, a laboratory for independent radio producers, writers, and performers. And today on the program, a true independent radio original. Joe Frank has been creating spellbinding and one-of-a-kind radio programs for over 30 years, and his dark, hilarious, and hypnotic work has been an influence on a lot of the audio documentary and storytelling that you hear today, programs like this one. It's been said that radio is the only art form that has the potential of being as intimate and as compelling as a voice in your own head. If that's the case, then that voice sounds like Joe Frank. On KCRW's Unfictional, this is called Dreamers.
He lived in a poor Arab village. The main street was an unpaved dirt road. Water was brought in by truck three times a week, from which his family filled their plastic jugs. And the electricity, which ran the TVs, the lights, and the fans, was provided by local generators powered by gasoline. His father had lost both legs to an artillery shell in the 1967 war. Now confined to a wheelchair, he was a devout Muslim who decried the existence of Israel. At the local mosque, he called for attacks on Israeli towns and cities and extolled the bravery of Hamas fighters, willing to risk their lives by murdering Jews. On the hill above the village, a new Israeli settlement was being built. So far, only a few concrete buildings with fortifications, surveillance outposts, and a perimeter of barbed wire. One day, a Hamas recruiter came to his school to enlist children as suicide bombers. Wishing to avenge his father, he began training. They wanted him to approach the new Israeli settlement dressed as a Hasidic student and blow himself up at the guard post. They fitted him with a vest with 8 sticks of dynamite, around which were ball bearings and nails, so that when he detonated the bomb, a cloud of shrapnel would explode outward, maiming and killing as many Israeli soldiers as possible. And so one morning, he found himself wearing a long black overcoat and a beaver hat, making his way up the road to the new settlement. He kept his eyes downcast and walked quickly, as though he was on an errand, when he heard a young Jewish soldier at the gate call out to him, "Stop. Who are you? Where are you going? If you take one more step, I will be forced to shoot." His heart pounding and his body drenched with perspiration, he ignored the soldier's warning and continued moving forward, his thumb poised on the button that would detonate the bomb. When, suddenly, he woke up and realized he was not an Arab boy about to kill himself and murder others, but an Israeli soldier who'd fallen asleep at his post overlooking the very Arab village he just dreamt he was from. Born in the Orthodox Jewish community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, he'd only recently come to Israel with his family. Now in the army, and no longer under the thumb of his strictly religious father, he had renounced his faith and become a secular Jew. The truth is that he had come to hate God. In his view, the deity was nothing more than a cruel and malicious old pervert. He imagined God pacing from room to room in his mansion in heaven, dreaming up new catastrophes on earth. African famine, genocide, and pandemic disease were deeply satisfying to him, but his greatest achievement remained the Nazi death camps of the 1940s. Nevertheless, the future was full of promise, with the proliferation of chemical, biological, and atomic weapons already being carried in the briefcases, backpacks, and heels of psychopathic religious killers. Yes, the future was rife with wonderfully hellish scenarios, And while God waited impatiently for them to unfold, he liked to keep things interesting with a plane crash, a forest fire, a ship lost at sea, a hostage crisis gone terribly wrong. If God were a resident on Earth, he thought, he would be considered criminally insane. And now he was looking down the road at a young Hasidic student quickly approaching on foot, the same figure he'd imagined himself to be in his dream. And he called out, "Stop! Who goes there? Who are you? Who are you visiting? What is your purpose?" But the young Hasid didn't answer. And he called out again, "If you do not stop, I will be forced to shoot." But even this warning did not deter the student, who continued to approach. And he called out again, "One more step, and I will open fire." And the only thing that prevented him from doing so was his awareness of the existence of a deaf Hasid who lived in a nearby settlement, considered a saint on earth, one of Israel's most treasured scholars. From infancy, he'd been able to read the Talmud, and now, barely a teenager, he'd already written brilliant commentaries on Holy Scripture that raised profound questions rather than offer narrow, dogmatic answers. It was said that he was beyond religion. And so, either this deaf saint or a would-be suicide bomber wearing a kaftan and a beaver hat continued to approach, unresponsive to the young soldier's warnings. And soon he would be close enough to hurl a grenade and to press the button on an exploding vest to blow up a bunker, allowing a small army of Arab assassins to come in and destroy the settlement. Now approaching the checkpoint at this very moment was the pastor of a church in Willow Cross, Mississippi. He was riding with his family in their Ford Explorer. They'd spent that afternoon at the Israeli settlement as guests of the chief rabbi there, where the pastor had enjoyed a wonderfully stimulating conversation with their host on the question, "To whom is the Holy Land more sacred?" The pastor spoke of his respect for the Jews, insofar as they were the original people of the book. But this land, he argued, was where God's only son had been brought to Bethlehem, where, on Golgotha, Jesus had been crucified and resurrected 3 days later. This was where Jesus had walked among the people and preached and performed miracles, healing the sick, raising the dead, feeding the thousands with a single fish and a loaf of bread. This was where, at the Last Supper, he'd learned who would betray him and who would remain his disciples. So this was sacred and hallowed Christian ground. And now the pastor and his wife and son and daughter were riding down a road on their way out of the Israeli settlement, singing, "My Bible for a Road Map," when they saw the young Hasid trudging toward the guard post. And as they approached him, the pastor experienced a blinding flash, then profound silence for what seemed like an eternity, and then the ear-splitting thunder of an explosion. And he felt a rush of hurricane-like wind and could feel the car lifted high above the road and slowly spinning in the air in an arc through empty space. And his last thoughts were for his wife and 2 children. When he woke up and realized he'd been dreaming. He was at home in Mississippi. It was one of those warm, balmy summer nights. He could hear the branches of the willow tree brushing against the side of the roof, the sound of a distant freight train, and a dog barking. The dream had been so terrifying that he found himself drenched with sweat, and yet, at the same time, felt chilled to the bone, his body trembling. He looked over and observed his wife sleeping. Then he saw the packed suitcases, the passports laid out on a table next to the American Express traveler's checks, and remembered they were about to fly to the Holy Land. He looked at the alarm clock, its glowing phosphorescent dial, reading 5:10, and knew that in a few minutes the alarm would go off, because they had to be at the airport by 7. he rose from his bed and walked down the hall to the children's room and looked in at his son and daughter, who were sleeping. His little girl hugging her doll, his son sucking his thumb, his new baseball mitt on the floor beside his bed. Then he went downstairs, poured two fingers of Jack Daniels into a water glass, and drank it down. And he walked out onto the porch and listened to the crickets and the wind rustling the leaves of the willow tree. And he could not help but feel that his dream was a foreshadowing of what was to come, a tragic vision of the future. His family was excited about going to Palestine. For his wife, a devout Christian, this was the trip of a lifetime. This was where she would be able to touch the very soil upon which Jesus had walked. Then he heard the alarm clock ring and saw a light go on in the upstairs bedroom, and then a dimmer light in the curtained hallway window, and then another light in the children's bedroom. And he heard the faint sound of a faucet being turned on and the excited voices of his children, and a radio turned to bluegrass music. And he walked out onto the lawn and knelt and clasped his hands and looked up at the star-filled sky and asked God for guidance. But he heard nothing but the sound of the crickets and the wind and a distant freight train that was taking forever to pass. And seen from high above, the freight train was moving along a river, beyond which was a fenced-off field in which horses were quietly standing and sleeping, and barns and outbuildings and fields of cotton, and a small town with a single main street leading to a courthouse square with a monument of a Confederate soldier on a pedestal with the names of the dead from the town, and steepled churches, and single and two-lane blacktops feeding into a larger interstate with steady traffic, and then suburbs and feeder roads and shopping centers and malls and gas stations and used car lots and bridges over rivers leading into cities with their capital buildings and business districts and residential high-rises and hospitals and stadiums and concert halls, their lights still twinkling as dawn was creeping over the horizon, and beyond that, enormous plains and great forests and huge river systems leading to the foothills of purple mountains that ran north and south, and beyond that, the sparkling expanse of deep blue oceans and the contours of Europe and Asia, where there was a light side and a dark side as the globe turned in the sunlight. And seen from even higher above and at a greater distance, the earth receding into a small stone in the firmament, and further back, our solar system disappearing into the Milky Way, and further back yet, into the darkness of the most profound silence imaginable, in the endless, the unknowable, and the infinity of time and space, without beginning or end.
I once saw a picture of Doris Day in her later years. And I don't know if you remember, but I suspect you and I both just creamed for Doris Day.
No, you did. I didn't.
Oh, you never found Doris Day just the sexiest, most wonderful when you were like in high school?
I don't think so.
You never loved Doris Day, that little face, that little peachy, rosy cheeks, and her sweet little nose and her butt? Guys like me, and, you know, since I've never seen you in person, I don't know if it could be, you know, you... But guys like me could never have hoped to bed Doris Day. Could never have hoped to be her companion, her lover, to have her naked under me. It was a fantasy beyond any possibility. But I saw on the cover of a cheap Inquirer-type newspaper a picture of Doris Day as beat up and bloated as you could imagine, wearing dark sunglasses and bloated and fat. And who do you think was accompanying her? The most grotesque, fat little old man with jowls like a turkey and no hair and a nose that twisted around from here to there. And I thought, wow, this guy waited a long time to be able to make some time with Doris. And there's another example of age being a leveler. This mutt, who 30 years before couldn't hold her luggage, is now accompanying her to the finer hotels of San Pedro.
I was sitting alone in a booth at a local diner when a sense of profound, almost paralyzing lethargy came over me. I'd finished my dinner and paid the check, but somehow I couldn't summon the strength to rise from the table. I ordered another cup of coffee and contemplated saying to the waiter, "Excuse me, I'm feeling ill. I need someone to call an ambulance." Then, finally, with considerable effort, I managed to lift myself from my chair and return to my apartment, where I felt so weak I was barely able to undress. The following day, I saw my doctor. Blood tests came up negative, but an MRI revealed a small cluster of nodules at the base of my spine. Holding the picture to the light, the doctor said, "I'm going to schedule you for a brain scan and a spinal tap." Startled, I asked him why these tests were necessary. He said he wanted to check my spinal fluid for cancer cells to determine if the nodules were malignancies that had traveled down through my spinal cord from a brain tumor. I left the office stunned. When I returned home, my apartment seemed weirdly, yet imperceptibly, altered. Was this my furniture? Was that my photo collage on the wall? Were those my clothes in the closet? I went into the bathroom, stared at my reflection in the mirror, and tried to make sense of the image before me. I felt like a character in a strange nightmare film, oddly removed and at the same time terrified. That Friday evening, a few hours after the spinal tap and the brain scan, my girlfriend and I attended a small dinner party. But I didn't tell her what had happened. The host, in his 40s, was a celebrated television commentator. Genial and at ease with everyone, he emanated a sense of relaxed authority. When we sat down to dinner, my girlfriend was seated next to him, while I sat across from them both. He told an amusing story about his prep school days that charmed everyone at the table, but I was barely able to follow the intricacies of his narrative. Instead, I found myself focusing on a drop of perspiration on a man's forehead, the freckles on the back of a woman's hand, another man's eyes weirdly magnified by the thick lenses of his glasses, a woman's red fingernail that was much shorter than her other nails, the sagging breasts of an older woman who was wearing an unbecoming low-cut gown. I'd been introduced to everyone at the table, but couldn't remember anyone's name, and found it impossible to follow the conversation. And I noticed that although the host at the beginning of the evening had attempted to distribute his attention equally to all the people at the table, he was now becoming more attentive to my girlfriend. I watched, as if from a great distance, in a dream, as she burst out laughing at something he told her and then became more thoughtful as their conversation turned serious. I noticed their chairs were very close, their bodies almost touching, as he reached over and poured wine for her, and they exchanged a meaningful look. Then I noticed him staring at me, as if he was sizing me up, studying me, assessing me, trying to figure out what I was made of, and wondering what she was doing with a man like me. And I thought I saw an expression of sympathy come over his face, as if he understood me. As if we were brothers, but that, nevertheless, he would still feel compelled to seduce her. When we returned home that night, she wanted to make love. I suspected her encounter with our host had fueled her ardor, which she was now redirecting to me. I declined, turned off the bedroom light, and in the long silence that followed, I could feel her frustration and rage. Finally, she said, What's been going on with you lately? You haven't been yourself. You hardly said a word at dinner. I didn't answer. A few minutes later, she got up, packed her overnight bag, and left. When I heard her car pull away from the curb and drive off, I felt relieved. I fell asleep and dreamt I was walking in a city at night when I noticed a street lamp flicker and go out as I passed beneath it. Then I was urinating on the floor of a vast shower room, experiencing a profound sense of relief and pleasure until I woke up with a feeling of warm wetness spreading around my thighs. I jumped out of bed, shocked by what had happened. Was I losing control of my bodily functions? Was this the first step toward incontinence, toward my own infantilization? I removed my soaked pajamas, stripped the bed, and threw everything into the washing machine. Then I scrubbed the mattress with soapy water, made a fresh bed over a thick towel to absorb the moisture from the wet spot, took a shower, and changed into clean pajamas. A week later, I returned to my doctor's office to learn the results of the tests. As I sat in the waiting room, I looked at a book of photographs of weightlifters in a variety of poses to accent their powerful physiques, taken on Muscle Beach in the 1930s and 40s. And I imagined how, in the decades that followed, their bodies had deteriorated with age, until now, more than 50 years later, they were either repulsively old or dead. So this accomplishment of theirs seemed an enormous waste of effort. Why not work at something that might last? But then I wondered if, in the overall scheme of things, anything endured. And that's when I heard the nurse call my name. "The doctor will see you now," she said.
I was amazed at how sturdy the tombstone has held up after 38 years. It looks barely broken in. But the short of it is, I had quite a moving experience coming to the grave of my father and placing stones on the grave. It's quite a lovely cemetery on a hill overlooking New York City.
In a home for the elderly. Most of the people there need to be bathed, dressed, and undressed, lifted out of beds and placed in wheelchairs, spoon-fed their meals, and taken to the bathroom to change their diapers. In the afternoon, they sit in their wheelchairs sleeping or staring off into space. Some of them have slipped into the early stages of dementia. Beyond the wall of the nursing home, across the street, you can hear children playing in a schoolyard. And I know that, long ago, these very old people also jumped rope, swung from monkey bars, played hopscotch, climbed trees, lay in the grass gazing up at the shifting shapes of clouds, and on drives back from the country, were enfolded, sleeping, in the arms of their loving parents, who knew that there, in that shining child, lay the future. And now, looking at them slumped in their wheelchairs, I think, this is the future. Time is invisible and irresistible. No matter what you do, you can't defend yourself against it. You can't fill a moat with flaming gasoline and stop its forward motion. You can't sit at the top of a ridge with a sniper's rifle and try to pick it off as it drives by on a highway late at night. You can't build a 19-foot concrete reinforced cinder block wall with steel piling sunk six stories into the ground and try to stop time, because it will pass right through it and you won't even see it. The wall will remain standing. People will continue looking off into the horizon, scanning the treetops with their binoculars. And they won't even know that 2 weeks ago Thursday, time rolled through at 4 p.m. and they didn't even notice. You can measure time and the eons it takes for mountains to rise, for continents to drift apart, for stars to be created and reach their maturity and explode. Or you can measure time and how many minutes you spend sitting in a dentist chair during root canal. Or in the interval between buying a lottery ticket and realizing it's worthless. And time can be measured in the time it takes you to get home on a Friday evening after work when traffic appears to be at a dead stop and you see the flashing lights of police cars and emergency vehicles a half mile ahead of you, clearly the signs of an accident. And you have to be home for a dinner party, and your cell phone has died, and you can't reach your wife, and you're banging your fists on the steering wheel and cursing, and then attempting to come to grips with the situation by telling yourself that, in the overall scheme of things, it doesn't really matter. 2 days from now, you think, I won't even remember this, because I'll be in the midst of yet another equally compelling set of stressful circumstances that will also eventually be forgotten. And if billions of years preceded our existence on Earth, billions of years will surely follow after our existence as well, so that our life here is like one flash of a strobe light, the wink of an eye. That ferry boat disaster was very distressing, the one in which hundreds of men, women, and children sank slowly into the ocean as the captain rowed away in a dinghy with the first mate, the pianist, and the girl who sang in the bar. I watch the evening news, and I see religion pitted against religion. I see children exploding as roadside bombs. I see one set of people who feel they have a direct line to God and His truth pitted against another set of people who believe they know the true mind of God. And both of these people's mission in life is either to convert the other to their faith or to annihilate them.
Dreamers was written and produced by Joe Frank, with Joe Frank and Larry Block, mixed by Ray Guarna. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional, part of KCRW's Independent Producer Project. The editor is Jacob Conrad. The music supervisor is Dan Wilcox. Production assistance from Monica Scott. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support of the Independent Producer Project and Unfictional. You can find past episodes at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, or join us on Facebook. You can podcast the show or listen on demand with the KCRW mobile app. And if you do like the program, please tell your friends about it. Or even better, leave a review on iTunes. I'm Bob Carlson, and however you choose to listen, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW and kcrw.com.